From the Lend to Grand Hill University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 25th day of May, 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett. Aaron Hager will be here to discuss resistance management in weeds and how that really has been going out the door. Then we'll take up the weather forecast with Mike Tenora. In Chicago today, July corn finished at 590 and three quarters. It was 3.5 higher. December down 4 at 516. July soybeans at 1324 were a half cent lower. And new crop November at $11.72 and a quarter, down 12 and three quarters. Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net now joins us to take a look at the Thursday marketplace. Hi, Matt. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What happened in Chicago today?
Well, you know, in all honesty, it's been a pretty darn good week. You look at your front month, both corn and beans have led the way. A fair amount of interest in owning those, but, you know, especially on soybeans. Well, really with corn, both of them, you saw a fair amount of spread action from, for instance, on corn, July to SEP. I mean, that thing was 8.75 wider here on the day, and so, or narrower, depending on how you want to talk it. But, you know, essentially you're up to almost 81 cents from of a inverse from July. You know, SEP and Dease corn and whatnot has still been overall good, just not near as good as July.
Yeah, so what's your expectations for the final trading day of the week and then next week, given the dry conditions that are still expected?
Yeah, I think a couple of things come to mind. So last Friday, you know, the COT report, Commitment of Traders report, most people were surprised that there wasn't more selling involved in that, that the funds maybe reduced their shorts just a little bit. But last week, you also had a lot of selling on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So Thursday and Monday and Tuesday of this week, I think there's a lot of buying going on. So I think this week, you're probably going to, the expectation that COT report won't change much. You know, I think a lot of people are under the impression, as well as I am, that the funds aren't necessarily going long corn based on dry weather, but I think that they're maybe assuming they got the cart out ahead of the horse just a little bit, and maybe are covering some of their short positions that they've added over the last couple of weeks. So, you know, I think a lot of that's been going on here. Most of us prefer as long as you get rain on the backside. I think the concerning thing for a lot of people, whether you're in Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, Nebraska, even in places, there's a lot of folks saying it's the driest they've been at this time of year in quite some time. So we certainly need to see this El Nino event get going in good fashion here before too long.
The markets will be closed Monday for the Memorial Day weekend. Sometimes those three-day weekends can be difficult, especially if the weather changes at this time of the year. For instance, more rainfall would be put into the forecast, or Washington, D.C. manages to get a resolution to the debt situation.
Right. I do think if you solve the debt issue, it's probably going to be supportive. I don't know that you're going to see any selling involved with something like that. But as you suggest, I think maybe the bigger concern, you know, is that you come in here and you kind of rally this market off much lower levels. You know, you're a quarter above or 25 cents above where we were at as far as Dease corn was concerned. The market closed today about 7 off the high. You're still 3 or 4 cents off the low. But by all means, this Dease corn market has had a pretty good run. And I think that if you turn around and you change the forecast and you say, hey, I think we're going to get into a more of an active pattern. I know I was texting a little bit with Eric Snodgrass here yesterday, and you know, he kind of feels like we might have the opportunity to see something like in the first into second week of June. So you've got to assume that you got to be a little bit wary there, because I think you could take the gains that we've seen and erase them in one session pretty quickly, especially with a lot of the talk with, you know, all the acres getting planted and so on and so forth. So it's definitely one of those extremely volatile times. And so I'd certainly like for producers that look at this as a gift, you know, to actually accept the gift and do something with it.
I guess we'll have to think about that. Yeah. You're right. I know you're right. Well, it's going to be hard.
You know, I know 516 Dease corn doesn't sound the greatest. And in all honesty, if you can't etch out a profit in the month of May, why would you lock much of that in? I kind of get that. You know, I think there could be carry in the market if you plant 92 million acres and have a big crop. There's no question. But is carry in the market going to mean a lot to you with interest rates where they're at. And so you'd need to get significantly more than what we would all call full carry to feel like that's really going to help you. But it is a long marketing year is what I'm kind of getting at. A lot of what you're going to do from this point forward depends on your insurance situation. So, if you didn't get 85%, then, you are not protected 502 or under. Whereas if you have 85%, you are. And so if you've got 75 or 80, a person certainly might consider doing a little bit of something after you just saw a 25-cent rally.
Hey, thanks much.
Absolutely.
That is Matt Bennett. He is with AgMarket.net. Aaron Hager penned earlier in the month of May an article about resistance, particularly in water hemp, to herbicides and how scientists have set about and the industry controlling that or trying to work through it. Aaron, thank you for being here. It's not horribly hard to understand, but you're talking about some of the things that producers in the industry and university researchers have done in the past as it's related to the development of glyphosate and other herbicide resistance and water hemp and other types of weeds, and suggest that none of them have worked all that well all the time, and there are other things that will have to happen in the future. Can you lay the stage of where this started?
Actually, Todd, it started decades ago because there was an ongoing debate among the weed science community whether it was a better technique to forestall the evolution of resistance to rotate herbicides, or was it a better strategy to combine or tank mix herbicides. And so our group here at Illinois set about trying to answer that question. And what we did is essentially worked with a retail applicator to look at their customer records and then went into those customer fields and sampled the water hemp populations and determined whether or not that they had glyphosate resistance. And so essentially what that work showed was that it actually was much more effective to forestall resistance if we combined effective herbicides together in every application. So, in other words, tank mixing was a better strategy than simply rotating herbicides. Now, at the time, Bayer Crop Science had launched a reasonably new initiative they called Respect the Rotation. And it was a very good effort on their part to get farmers to think about diversifying other than just using glyphosate-based products. Of course, they sold Liberty Link varieties at the time and Liberty Herbicide. But when we discovered the findings of our work, I actually called Bayer and said, "Now, what you're doing right now to get diversification, we think is a good thing, but we wanted to make you aware of what this paper is actually going to demonstrate." And to their credit and to other industries, companies in the industry, to their credit, they really picked up on this message to use effective tank mixtures. And it's hard really now to pick up an ag publication and look at a herbicide advertisement that doesn't mention something about, mixing or combining herbicides together. But my concern is that we've taken that too far now, because one thing that a lot of people probably are not aware of is all of that work that we did to demonstrate that tank mixtures were better than rotation, that was based on a target site-based glyphosate resistance. So there's been something that has occurred at the target site of glyphosate in these resistant populations that render glyphosate ineffective. But we really have not done much with target site-based resistance in our research and laboratory work and greenhouse work, really for about the last 7 to 10 years. What we really focus on now and where we see the larger and more significant challenges coming with water hemp is not with target site-based resistance, but rather non-target site. So, in other words, the target site of the herbicide has not necessarily changed, but something else has taken place in these resistant weeds that render them resistant. And most of what we do now, the mechanism that we are trying to understand, is what we refer to as metabolic herbicide resistance. So what do we mean by that? Very simply, the weeds take up the herbicide, but they've evolved mechanisms in which they're able to metabolize it or break it down before it's lethal. And that's a, if you think about this, that's actually the same type of technique that crops use to survive herbicides. The reason we do not kill corn when we spray it with atrazine is because the corn can rapidly metabolize it. So, in a strange sort of way, water hemp populations now have actually begun to mimic crops in how they selectively metabolize herbicides so that they're not lethal.
So to clarify, to begin with, it was about target sites, which normally I think were referenced as mode of action. And so you could rotate through mode of action, and then you said, well, not only mode of action, but we actually have to tank mix different types of herbicides as well. And then the adoption now is metabolic. And does that have any broader issues that come along with it? For instance, if a plant has developed the ability to metabolize a herbicide, might it metabolize other things as well faster and be able to survive different types of herbicides that might be used on it?
That, Todd, is really the most difficult part of dealing with metabolic resistance is that we have absolutely no predictability left. We do not know what works, what remains effective on these populations, and what doesn't. Best example I can give you is that we have water hemp populations that are resistant to herbicides that were never sprayed on that population previously. Why is this happening? We really don't know for sure why we're seeing these patterns that we are seeing, but it's not now that we're just concerned about resistance to, one or two different herbicides from one or two different classes. We have a population just miles from campus that has evolved resistance to herbicides from six different classes. That's a little bit unnerving when you think about, well, how many classes remain effective? And that number is getting very, very small these days. We're not going to see new silver bullet herbicides come into the marketplace. And you have to think like the folks that who are making these decisions in the industry, okay? Are we going to spend $350, $400 million to develop a new herbicide that's going to take 10 years from now before it sees the marketplace? With this uncertainty around metabolic resistance. And I'll share a true story with you. Several years ago, I was attending a meeting, I believe it was in New Orleans. And at the airport, I ran into one of our former graduate students who at the time was working for a company that still had a herbicide discovery program. And during the cab ride from the airport to the hotel, they told me that they had actually discovered a new mode of action. They had made the decision to begin advancing that through some of the early greenhouse biology screens. Then they screened it against some of these water hemp populations that has metabolic resistance. They couldn't control it. That new mode of action is now sitting on a shelf somewhere because it's not able to control these resistant populations, even though that herbicide has never been commercialized.
You close the article saying that the only, not the only thing left, but that the thing that producers must do to control water hemp is not to allow any plants that survive to actually leave seed in the field or in the combine if it happens to go through it. But what you don't say in the article, and I've heard you say this many times before, is that it may take a hoe. It may take walking those plants out of the field and bagging them up and getting rid of that seed. Is that what's left for producers if they really want to keep resistant water hemp out of their fields?
That is really the only thing that we know with any certainty, and that is if there's no seed produced at the end of the year, then there's no change in any frequency of any resistance traits. we caution people, you know, in the article, we say, you know, a few scattered females at the end of the year, they're not going to cause any harvest issues. They're not going to plug up the combine. But what happens if the seeds of those few females actually carry the next and newest resistance mechanism? That's the unnerving part of allowing these things to continue to produce seed at the end of the year. Now we may be rendering or costing ourselves money for decades into the future. We also caution folks that we simply cannot solve a problem that is caused by herbicides simply by using herbicides differently. It will not work. It is not sustainable. We do know that. We have demonstrated that over and over as our populations have continued to find new ways, new methods, new mechanisms to survive simply herbicides. If you cut that plant off, if you sever that plant off at the soil line, below that soil line, that plant will not contribute to a resistance problem in the future. We do know that. That is, again, the only thing that we know of right now. We also really try to get people to think, look, it's, you know, resistance issues are not only to our foliar applied herbicides. If we have resistance in water hemp to our foliar applied PPO inhibitors, there is also resistance there to the soil applied PPO inhibitors. And that's been a difficult concept for some people to grasp hold of. But as we continue to rely simply on herbicides, if we think that our solution is, you know, we're going to use a pre, we're going to use a post, we're going to layer another residual in with a post, what will happen over time is that length of residual that we get from those soil active herbicides is going to continue to get less and less. I went back and looked at some work that we did back in the late 1990s, the years I think were 96 and 97. Before we evolved resistance to PPO, if we would apply a soil-applied PPO inhibitor at 6 weeks after planting, we were still well above 90% control of water hemp. You can take that same soil-applied PPO inhibitor now at the same rates on a resistant population, and now at 6 weeks, we're less than 40% control. That is, again, this is a problem that continues to evolve. The next mechanism of resistance that water hemp does evolve could render some soil applieds almost useless in terms of the length of residual that they can provide for us. We just simply are not sure why we're seeing these patterns that we are seeing. So if we don't really understand what caused this, it makes coming up with a herbicide-only solution for this challenge pretty tenuous at best.
That's Aaron Hager. He's a weed scientist with the University of Illinois Extension here on the Urbana-Champaign campus. We'll hear a bit more from him tomorrow as it's related to the weed, Palmer amaranth. Mike Tenura is now here. He's from T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online to talk about the forecast. I think we'll detail what's been happening in the Midwest, if you can, for me, Mike. Let's start with the conditions over the last month and a half or so that allowed producers to move pretty quickly in the field. Just a quick overall assessment of how that appeared to go. And then what's been happening as of late, as they still have been able to really move because of open field conditions. But now we're thinking, hey, dry weather as well.
Well, that's always the tricky thing with this type of a setup. We've had a pretty dry April and May across the Corn Belt, and that has helped planting out quite a bit. We're having near record planting paces of corn and soybeans in some areas, and that's always the best way you want to start the growing season. In general, the earlier you get the crop in, the better it's going to be later, because you'll avoid some of the heat and some of the drier weather that becomes part of the climate later in the growing season. So part one of that equation has worked out pretty well. It's been pretty dry. Of course, a big chunk of the Corn Belt in the last 3 to 4 weeks, and extending even further back again to the start of May, we are trying to describe to you exactly where it's been dry, but it's kind of been a scattered mix across the heart of the Corn Belt. There's some dry pockets in the Dakotas and a few in Minnesota, and then it becomes more widespread as you move into eastern Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, into Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Indiana and Ohio are kind of on the edge of the dryness at this point in time. But the point, Todd, is that it's actually getting pretty dry. If you look at the coverage of U.S. corn production that was drier than normal over the last 30 days, It's actually the highest for this point in the growing season, which is day 16 since half the crop was planted, in more than 11 years. Our records go back to about 2012. So at this point in the season, it's actually drier when measured over the last 30 days. It's the same story over the last 60 days, but we only have data back to 2014. And we do know that 2012 was drier than this. So we're not in a major drought like 2012 was starting out, but there are some warning signs flashing here that it's getting a little too dry. And even though it's been great for planting to this point, we know that once we get into June, and especially into the middle of June, dry weather is no longer what you would like to see.
You know, just offhand, and you'll have to tell me whether you agree with this assessment or not. Generally speaking, in June and July, what makes for a really good crop is about an inch of rain per week, particularly in July. Given that, what do you see as it relates to potential for rainfall in any adequate amounts over the next 2 weeks?
Well, the first week does not look very good for rain at all. A lot of the Corn Belt is going to stay dry with little to no rain, and that's because of a large surface level high in the eastern U.S., and that will basically keep things the same as they have been for the last few days going forward for another 5 to 7 days. So essentially, it's going to get drier into the end of the month, and what that will end up doing is it will leave the seven-state Corn Belt the driest in since 1992 over the period of April and May combined. So this is an unusual situation. Once we get into June, which starts on Wednesday, there are some shower and thunderstorm chances out there, but they don't look to be that ideal. We will see a cool front move through over the second half of next week. And the big wild card with that setup is whether or not humidity values will be high enough for that front to generate heavy rainfall. At this point in time, it just looks like more of a setup where you would see scattered showers and thunderstorms with maybe a quarter of an inch to three quarters of an inch over the second half of next week across a pretty big area. While this certainly will be welcome after that front moves through, it probably would dry out again. And that's where we have some concern that this pattern is not breaking. And in fact, it might well continue into the first week and maybe the first 10 days of June the way it looks now.
Where are the driest regions at this time?
Well, it certainly would be centered on Missouri, the northern half of Missouri, and then extending into parts of Iowa and also nearby areas of Nebraska and South Dakota. Illinois is starting to get in on some of this, with a few locations having been pretty dry over the last 60 days. But the thing you need to keep in mind is that you look out your window now and you're like, this guy might be a little crazy. It doesn't seem that dry to me looking out my window and just knowing what my fields look like. But what you need to keep in mind is that the way I'm thinking about it is by incorporating the lack of rain over the next 7 days. And what will these charts and these maps look like once we get to May 31st? And that's when you'll start to notice this a lot more than we do at the moment, because it'll keep getting drier and it will keep on expanding. And, you know, this all could come to a quick end by the time we get to June 10th if things were to suddenly change. But, you know, the way we see it right now, it's actually just going to get drier as we head into June.
Well, we'll talk to you on the first day of June next week and see how things have progressed. Thanks much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that sounds great, Todd.
That's Mike Tenuri. He is with T-Storm Weather. Joined us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.